Let's get to the HCI.
Yeah, I'm highly confident that I have a deep understanding of what we're about to talk about.
So the paper is called AI Makes You Smarter, But None the Wiser. The Disconnect Between Performance and Metacognition. Main author, Daniela Fernandez, who I think is in Finland.
Yeah, Aalto University.
One of your own, I guess you could say.
Yeah, we're, you know, the Finnish HCI community is small and highly concentrated in Aalto, but we're one big family.
And the idea of the paper is to look kind of at the Dunning-Kruger effect, at people's metacognition when using AI for logical questions or logical puzzles. Do you want to explain the Dunning-Kruger effect?
Yeah, so this is the joke that I just made, that the Dunning-Kruger effect is that as you are less knowledgeable about something, you are more confident about something, about your level of knowledge. So if you're really wise in a topic, you know the limits to your knowledge. And if you're kind of dumb at a topic, you think you're smarter than you are.
Yeah. And they're kind of looking at that in, with the idea of using AI to kind of balance out your skills. So usually skills follow a curve, like a bell curve, and people tend to think they're better than the average. And so if you fall below average, you think you're better. And if you fall really high above the average, you think you're worse, because people tend to just think that they're slightly above average. So then the Dunning-Kruger effect, I think, has been questioned a little bit. They kind of talked about it in this experiment where they say, oh, people think it's called statistical anomaly. Which I don't think they kind of delved in enough to say that it isn't.
I feel like they got a review comment that was like, isn't this whole thing a bunch of BS? And they were like, yeah, some people think it's a bunch of BS. Anyway.
And I don't know her name, but there's a woman who does science TikToks. I think it's something Fry. Or am I confusing her with Stephen Fry? But she did one recently where she...
I was just going to make the joke. The woman you're confusing with Stephen Fry, I think it's Sandy Toksvig now. Okay. Thank you.
So she was saying that it looks like a statistical anomaly, mostly because of what I was saying earlier, that most people think that they're above average. So initially, the Dunning-Kruger effect was for ability in, was it logic puzzles?
I think so. Yeah, I think that's why they redid the same thing here.
Yeah, so it's taken a life of its own now that people have this graph that is completely different to what Dunning-Kruger originally mm-hmm. found, where the line of the graph goes really high, then really low, then starts slowly ramping up again, which is like when you don't know anything, you estimate that you're really bad at the thing, so your accuracy is good. When you find a little bit out about a topic, then you get overconfident. So then your accuracy drops completely because you're like, oh, I'm really good at this now. I know a little bit, even though a little bit is not, it's like 10% of whatever the max is.
Yeah, yeah.
And then as you become more of an expert, you become well-tuned with your accuracy, you have better metacognition, so then the graph goes back up. But that wasn't really what Dunning-Kruger found. It was like one, if you're an expert, the line is kind of slightly, a slight gradient from middle to slightly high. And then if you're not an expert, then it's a slight gradient from slightly high to slightly lower. So it's kind of like a sideways X, nothing like this. Up and down and up and down.
Yeah, for a really informative look, if you, like me, could not follow Diego's descriptions of graphs, and you, like me, have a digital device next to you, Google Dunning-Kruger effect. First, look at the Google Images pictures where it looks like a roller coaster, and then click into the Wikipedia page where there's the actual graph from their paper, and it's like the least dramatic slope ever. Like, this is such a microcosm for when science breaks into popular science, into the mainstream, that the actual finding is like an interesting, statistically significant, like mild difference between experts and non-experts or high and low competence people. And then the pop science version is like, as soon as you learn a little about something, you become the world's biggest idiot.
I can't even find the picture on Wikipedia.
You must have some kind of plug-in extension blocking images, because it is literally the top left or top right of the page.
Send me a link. Maybe
I'll send you a screenshot, buddy.
This is simple Wikipedia. How did I get there?
Do you have it default in your browser because it's easier to understand?
Yeah, I'm too dumb for normal Wikipedia. Oh, wow. Like the... Okay, thank you.
You can see from my screenshot, you cannot miss where the image is.
But also the graph, like the tiniest overlap at the very end. Okay, so yeah. Now that we're all caught up on the Dunning-Kruger effect, you can
now
see
that you've learned
picture.
10% of the Dunning-Kruger effect and you're 100% confident about how it works.
Exactly. You can see that at the very, very end of the graph, people are slightly better than they think they are. So their actual performance is slightly better than their perceived performance. And that's where they got the idea of if you're a complete expert, you're really good at something, you undershoot your ability, your confidence in your ability is a little lower than it should be, whereas otherwise it's the opposite. But I think you can see from the graph that it's just not as extensive or extreme as other people make it out to be.
Yeah, and just because it's overhyped in popular science doesn't mean that it's not an effect that's worth, like, yeah, replicating and seeing, does this effect hold in other situations? Is this effect made better or worse by AI? Completely normal and good that they would try to find this effect in this paper.
I think it's actually useful in understanding if there is a Dunning-Kruger effect at all, because now with the use of AI in this paper, it kind of plateaus people's actual ability. So if you do find the paper, there's a nice graph there where they compare the actual performance of people not using AI in these logical puzzles against how people do if they get to use ChatGPT 4.0. And another description of a graph coming. One is just a bell curve, and then if you get to use AI, you're basically like a tower at the very high end of the bell curve, where people are all doing 15 out of 20 about.
Yeah, it used to be that the average was people getting 10 out of 20, and it was spread around that, and now, yeah, everyone's getting 15 out of 20. Not many getting better, not many getting worse than that.
And they actually have an example of a question that I looked at and I was like, oh, would I be able to do this? No, I was actually awful at the question. I'll give it to you. Maybe you can do it.
Yeah, hit me. I like these LSAT style questions.
Okay. It has been proven that the lie detector can be fooled. If one is truly aware that one is lying when in fact one is, then the lie detector is worthless. The author of this argument implies that 1, the lie detector is sometimes worthless. 2, the lie detector is a useless device. 3, no one can fool the lie detector all the time. 4, a good liar can fool the device. And 5, a lie detector is often inaccurate.
Yeah, I would say 2 and 4. For that.
Okay. I also thought it was 4. Now, I didn't actually Google the right answer.
Oh, is this not multiple answer, multiple choice?
No. So I put it into Google Gemini and it told me it was 1 because that's the only one that can be proved from the logical question, whereas the other ones aren't necessarily provable. So I can see from the graph that we looked at where people get 15 out of 20 with AI, where it pushes everyone basically to a good average.
Yeah.
If Gemini is correct, then I would be similarly pushed to that high average. And that's another thing where some people thought, okay, they use ChatGPT. If ChatGPT is correct, it sounds correct, so I'm just going to put it in as the answer. So part of the paper is saying that people, after using ChatGPT, don't think about it further to say, okay, well, is this actually the correct answer? So there's a discussion point where they say there's a reduction of metacognition because people become lazy, basically. And they're like, okay, this sounds correct, I'm just going to use it. I don't know if I agree with it, because personally, I'm like, it sounds correct. And if it wasn't correct, I don't think I'm smart enough to notice. So I don't know if it's really that I'm being lazy, more that I'm just not as good as Gemini at this.
Yeah, it might be that you're correctly metacognitively assessing that I don't know what the hell I'm doing. So you're deferring to Gemini, who's a bit smarter. But what you're misassessing is not your own cognition. It's not a problem of metacognition. What you're misassessing is Gemini's ability, that you're fully aware that you're deferring.
Yes, I'm fully aware that Gemini is better.
That you're aware, and it might be the right solution to defer. Like, it might be the optimal decision for a fellow such as yourself or myself to trust the AI on this.
Yes, a fellow such as myself. So I'll explain a bit of the study. So the way the study worked was there's two parts to this. The first part, they got like 150 or 160-ish participants to do the 20 LSAT style questions. Do you want to explain what LSAT is for people not from America?
Yeah, so if you're applying to go to law school in America, you don't get directly into a bachelor's law program. You first do a bachelor's degree, then you separately apply to go to law school as a graduate program. And one of the entry requirements for law school is the LSAT, the standardized test for law school. I guess it's law school aptitude test. Yeah, so it's mostly, I think there's a grammar part, like a language part of it, and there's a logic part of the LSAT exam, and it has logical puzzles, just like the one Diego described.
Yeah, so in this one, they had 20 logic questions, mirroring, I believe, the Dunning-Kruger paper, and also mirroring a paper by Janssen et al. 2021, which they compared the data against. So in this one, they got 160 or so people to do the same type of questions, I assume the same questions, as the Janssen paper, except they had a ChatGPT window beside it where they could use it unlimited number of times, where people could, while they were answering these questions, ask the ChatGPT, oh, is this the right answer? What do you think? And so on. So then afterwards, or beforehand, they asked, how well do you think you'll do? How well do you think you'll do with AI? How much do you trust AI? So it was a lot of kind of trying to be metacognitively aware of your performance. One of the things about it was that they looked at kind of your ability to be metacognitively aware as your the difference between how many questions you thought you get right and how many questions you actually got right. But I feel like when you get put in an experiment and they say, okay, how many questions of this logic puzzle do you think you'll get right? I would have no idea. I don't know how hard those logic puzzles are. I've never done an LSAT. Mm-hmm. Like, how would I have any idea other than probably
most Americans who have not applied to law school would not know how hard LSAT puzzles are. You would only know if you're like A, you applied to law school, or you're a mega nerd like me who in high school was like, LSAT puzzles sound fun.
And I think only 10% or less of the people who did this study reported that they had done LSAT style questions before, and they even looked at the performance between those people and the rest of the group, and it wasn't kind of significantly different. But my point is kind of that, like, the best guess that I would have is I'm probably slightly better than average if I...
Yeah, you do have a PhD. Like, you are smart. I, as much as it pains me to say.
So, I don't know how useful that is as a metric, okay? Most people are going to guess slightly better than average. And then some of them will achieve that and some of them won't, but let's not focus on that part. They ask you that, they have you do the experiment, and then they compared... Instead of having a control group that would do the questions without the AI, they just compared it against a large sample of 3,543 participants that Janssen et al. Got, which I thought was an interesting way to go about it. Not how I would normally do experiments. But thankfully, I think something that saved this paper in my mind is that they did a study too where they actually did control.
Yes.
I don't know why they wouldn't just do that from the start, but an interesting part is that the AI users in the first study that they did canceled out the Dunning-Kruger effect. So the graph that you'd normally see where estimated and achieved kind of slightly crosses over at the end, when participants were using AI, the crossover doesn't happen. So they stay kind of basically the same distance from each other the whole time. So does it tell us something about the Dunning-Kruger effect? If everyone is basically above average in performance, then they're all very accurate at estimating their ability.
Yeah, if we're not, like, this is the problem with not getting a lot of variance, right? If the whole original Dunning-Kruger effect is because there's variance in competence, that variance has also an interaction with variance in estimation of ability. Now, if everyone has the same competence, yeah, then it's a flat, like, there's no interaction because there's no variance in the first variable.
They did the second study, and the two things that they changed was they had a control group of 250 participants that completed the no AI group, and then 250 that completed AI assistance. But they also incentivized people to be as accurate as possible in their predictions of their performance, basically. So they said the closer you are to actually predicting how many answers out of 20 you'll get right, the more money you'll make. So they, I think they got paid £750 for doing the experiment at all, because it wasn't prolific. And then the bonus of 50 cents if they were highly accurate, and then none of that at all if they weren't accurate. No one did this, I think, from looking at the data, but personally, I'd be like, okay, I'm going to get none right. I guess 50 cents isn't that much.
Dunning and Kruger in there together, both trying to maintain a bell curve of responses.
And then, in the second one, once again, they found the same thing. People not using AI basically matched the Janssen et al. Group in terms of bell curve. They were slightly better. So instead of being centered over the 10, they seem to be centered around 13 or so, but they're still way lower than people using ChatGPT. And once again, kind of the Dunning-Kruger effect is non-existent there. People's achieved and estimated never crosses over. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting paper, I think. It kind of offers some insights into, can we use AI for logic tasks? Do people perform better if they do? How does that affect their metacognition about themselves? But I do have some questions about Dunning-Kruger overall that kind of weren't answered.
Yeah, I think I focused on both how you said it's like people basically choosing to trust AI as an optimal strategy, and like acknowledging that sometimes blindly trusting AI is not a like metacognitively lazy strategy. It's like a reasoned strategy, like you're actively deciding to do that for tasks like this where you might be thinking that your own competence is much lower than AI. And also just reflecting on then what does that mean we're measuring here? Is it actually metacognition? That the lab that I work in, as we'll talk about in the next segment, we talk a lot about metacognition, and we look at it as kind of a process, like the same way cognition is a process rather than measuring only kind of an outcome of cognition. Mm-hmm. I would think that what they're measuring here is something. It might be trust in AI. It might be a combination of like metacognitive effort and deferral or something. But it's not clear to me that what they're measuring is this like post hoc metacognition ability, if only because it's not always clear or necessary that a participant actually put any cognitive effort toward the puzzle themselves. That, like you said, if it generates a smooth sounding response to a logic puzzle that did your brain in, you might just be like, yeah, sure, that sounds good.
Yeah, and I don't want to like throw this study under the bus.
No,
like,
not at all. I think it's a good study in a general sense.
And they found out more things than I talked about. So they looked at AI literacy, and mm-hmm. that seemed to make you worse at self-assessment. Somehow, the more you knew about AI, the less you were able to self-assess, maybe because if you know a lot about AI, you think AI is really bad, and so you're going to think you're going to perform worse, or I'm not sure what the kind of logic is there, but they did find other things as well, like higher confidence correlates with lower self-assessment accuracy, kind of what you would expect with Dunning-Kruger effect. So, and they did some analyses that I don't understand properly, so I'm not going
to I didn't get it, the ROC and area under the curve thing. I think that to me was like when... no offense, I don't know, maybe they'll be listening to this, but that was like when the one tool in your toolbox is building a machine learning model, everything looks like a nail. That you're like, I don't really, I have a bunch of data, I guess I should calculate the AUC for this. Like, I guess you should, I don't know. You did fine without it.
But does it make you think about how using AI might affect students' metacognition if they trust blindly in their answers to quizzes? Because we were saying earlier, in an earlier episode, that basically if we know you're going to use AI, we'll give you a B and let you go, because it really flattens the curve of responses and performance. Yeah. So like we saw in this paper where people basically got a B in this test.
There's a B?
Nearly all of them got a B in this test if they use AI. It really flattens performance. Now, if all you want is performance, then obviously use AI and get your degree, get your nut, as they say. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I learned about how the task works by asking Gemini, because I didn't know it was like, okay, you need to
peruse. These conditional things and, hitting me with a peruse.
I didn't know I'd had to peruse the question so deeply to be like, okay, which one is the only one that can prove this? So I don't know if it removes metacognition or improves metacognition. It really probably is kind of a case-by-case basis on how people use it.
Yeah, and I think definitely if a tool like this was... So this will really closely tie into what we'll talk about in the second segment. But anyway, in learning sciences right now, I would say the biggest paper in the last year was a paper called Beware of Metacognitive Laziness by Yizhao Fan and Dragan Gasevich's team. This was a paper basically looking at when students would use GPT for writing support, and seeing if students were just trying to maximize their grade on the essay, it's exactly what you said, that their cognitive abilities were stronger when using AI as support, but their metacognitive abilities kind of eroded, that, yeah, if you're relying on GPT to write an essay for you, you're not developing skills in thinking through how to write an essay, like making a plan of like how to structure an argument, etc. But a tool that kind of both helps you on the cognitive side and supports metacognition can be possibly useful. That if, like you, after people ask the GPT or Gemini or whatever for help with the logic puzzle, if there was then a second step of like, now reflect on how GPT got to this answer and like how that might help you approach puzzles like this in the future, then at least now there's this like metacognitive reflection step that might help you improve your strategies later on. So I think there is room for AI to be helpful with not just like making the cognition part easy, but making the metacognition more strong. But if you're completely deferring that planning and reflecting and all of that, not doing any of that, and just letting the task execution be done by AI, well, yeah, you're both not putting in the cognitive effort and you're going to degrade your ability to not grow your ability to put in that effort in the future.
One thing this made me think about was, so when I did my PhD, I did it on kind of behavior change, persuasive design, motivation, kind of what I did my master's and undergrad in as well. And the reason I got into this or was interested in this kind of research was because I was an awful procrastinator. I would leave everything until the last minute, wait until like the stress got overwhelming, that it switched something in my brain where things that were boring before weren't boring anymore because I was so hyped up on adrenaline. And then I would actually finish everything. I think people talk about how rely on this as a thing and then they never learn kind of good coping mechanisms for actually doing research. Or people that peak earlier than others might
have. Still waiting to peak myself.
So that's why I got into motivation research. And when I was doing my PhD, I started trying to use it like to be able to write, because during COVID, when you're at home and all you can do is write or sit in the garden, you kind of need something extra to help with the motivation. So I created this kind of app that every time I did the amount of work I thought I needed to do per day, which I put as 5 hours for a while, and then 4 hours afterwards, was nice. That if I did that, I get
10 kind year of a track point. Baby
10 year track, I get a point, and if I got, I think it was 50 or 100 of those points, because I had measured out how many days it would take to finish, I could buy myself a large purchase, which was like a 3,000 euro PC that I've been wanting for a while. And it really worked. Like I was there doing my 4 hours. I would do 2 hours before lunch, 2 hours after lunch, go out in the garden because it was nice.
Three martini lunch. Yeah, yeah. Academic lifestyle.
But then when I finished my PhD, I was thinking, okay, I still need that motivation. Maybe I have a bit of ADHD or something. So I'm going to kind of continue on this app and actually make it useful for me. But then I didn't even have the motivation to make the motivational tool.
But then AI support came along.
Exactly. You know where I'm going.
Yeah.
Gemini actually let me vibe code, as all the kids are calling it. And something that would have taken me, I'd say like 3 months to make, it made in like a day. And one of the problems I had was that I was thinking of like how to structure and the method to use and so on while I was coding. I didn't first create a plan and then implement the plan. I was like planning and implementing all at the same time. And that like really tired me out. Whereas now I have one AI, Gemini, making the plan. And then I have another AI, Claude, implementing the plan. So I've outsourced every single part of the thinking out of this. And the only thing I'm doing is making decisions. I'm like, okay, this balancing is a bit wrong. This is the next feature you need to add. And like we were saying, that I probably did not learn how to code from this, but I got my result, which is I now have an app that I can put in the description if other people want to try it.
And I mean, your goal in the end was to make this app that you will have in the show notes so other people other than me can try it, as you just said. But yeah, your goal here was to make this app. It was not to learn how to code this app necessarily. So I don't really fault you for going this way and outsourcing the effort around it. And I think in the end, like the project management skill of like figuring out a way to produce the content I want, you learned a different metacognitive skill in this, and it was that's probably going to be useful to you. I would imagine you will at some point again orchestrate multiple AI agents to carry out some task or another for you.
I think if I was a richer man, I would have just paid people to make an app for me. And I would have been doing the same kind of project management
as it is.
Maybe now that I have PhD students, I can convince them to make apps for me.
That's why we get into the business, folks. Yeah, no, I agree that like for a task like that, it's A, more competent, and B, it would like... To an extent, it would be a big waste of your time to be putting in the same amount of time it would have taken you to try to code that for the same result, where if your goal was not to learn how to become a better front-end developer, but to just have this working app, yeah, why not just have Spicy Autocomplete do it for you?
And people also say that kind of vibe-coded apps are worse in the sense security-wise, because AI obviously... isn't as good as like a really competent person.
Yeah.
But
where are you gonna find one of those?
Yeah, like people who are making apps like initially, they're also really bad at creating security. So any kind of home spun app is gonna have those problems. It just means that more people are creating apps, which I don't wanna say democratizes technology, because that's a wanky way that AI people make it so that they can do whatever they want. But it does, it's giving you that step where my problem was I needed the motivation to get like slightly further. And yeah, it's giving you that step.
Definitely, that like you, it didn't come up with an app to make. You had an idea of what you wanted made and then you orchestrated it being made. I'm here for it.
So will we move on to your topic now?
Yeah, sure. Let's move on to the research portion of the day. I didn't even like name a paper for us to read for this, but you can read a bunch of any of my recent papers. I'm going to talk about my metacognitive AI. This is the AI proactive speech agent that I've been working on designing, researching with since I came here to University of Oulu.
You're creating an AI?
Well, creating a proactive agent. I have a hand in the like the dialogue management, but I don't know. If you want to call it symbolic AI, you can, but I think it's also fine to just say it's a speech agent. We don't need to, it's not important what the architecture of it is. It's more important what the concept that it's instantiating or like that it's symbolizing is. And that is metacognitive support for collaborative learning. So we just talked about metacognition and cognition, that metacognition is thinking about your own thinking. Meta is, you know, about its, meta means about oneself or about itself. So metacognition is cognition about cognition. We in the lab that I work in, the learning and educational technology lab here, they, before I ever got here, were doing lots and lots of research about self-regulated learning. So how do we make plans, carry out our strategies, and then reflect? And they've especially been interested in that stuff in the context of collaborative learning. So how do we do all that stuff during group learning, and how do we support each other, and how do we work as a group, make plans as a group, etc. And they found all sorts of things over the past decade or so of being able to identify when this regulation is happening, when plans are being made and reflection is happening, or when those things aren't happening. But it's been really hard in the past to support that in real time, that you can kind of look at a video afterwards and say like, oh, here's where there was regulation, or here's where they could have regulated, the group could have realized something was going wrong and changed their strategy, but they didn't. And maybe a teacher who's like right at the, like working with a group right at the right moment could catch these things. But right now, at least before I joined the lab, there wasn't a good way to support that in real time and to catch when there were these challenges and kind of help groups work through them, change their strategy, reflect, think about their thinking. So they hired me basically to design a proactive speech agent that can help support metacognition. So we designed my metacognitive AI. Basically, it listens to student groups having a conversation and it tries to detect what we call regulatory triggers, so the kind of challenging moments that call for regulation, that call for you to think about what you're doing and change strategies or adapt your strategy in some way.
Do you have like an example of that, what that would
look
like?
So we kind of break it down into different categories. So there might be metacognitive triggers. So a metacognitive trigger would be when you don't understand the rules of a task or the instructions of a task. So if a group is, you know, we did step two for the worksheet and we're not really sure what we're supposed to do for step three, this would be a metacognitive trigger. We don't know how to move forward. We're confused and we need something on this meta level. We need more instructions about the task, or we need to reread the full instructions or something like that. Or you might have a cognitive trigger. So you might just misunderstand something about the content itself. So you might think, why we're doing a physics task right now. We have a Bunsen burner and water, and the water says it's 93 degrees. Why is it not boiling right now? That would be a cognitive trigger. You're confused about the content. You're wondering why the water isn't boiling at 93 degrees, because that's not the boiling point of water, 100 is. Or you might have socio-emotional triggers. So one person might be a jerk, and they might be disrupting the learning for everyone else, or calling you names or whatever. And that's disrupting things for you. So you need to even things out socio-emotionally.
Classic group project dynamics.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Or like maybe the biggest group project trigger is behavioral. So two people are doing all the work and one is just sitting back, not participating. Then that the group probably isn't progressing very well, and there's growing tension because two people are doing everything and one person's just sitting back doing nothing. So we wanted Mai to be able to detect all of these different kinds of triggers from spoken interaction, and we wanted to give support. So we designed with some teachers what sorts of things a teacher would say when they notice these different things. So if there's a metacognitive trigger, if there's a misunderstanding about the rules or the instructions, Mai might say, good job discussing the task so far. How can you work together to better understand what you need to do next? Or if there's a cognitive trigger, so confusion about the content itself, Mai might say, there might be some confusion in the air. What resources do you have to learn more about this topic? So kind of encouraging students to either like check a textbook or like ask a teacher, like, we don't know what's happening right now, that kind of thing.
I like your fake happy AI intonation.
I've heard the AI say these things so many times that I can only do the real prompts now. We basically didn't do it fake happy like that the first time we piloted this. So we did a Wizard of Oz pilot with university students, with teacher training students. And basically it just said something like, how can you better understand this concept? Or what can you do to figure out the instructions right now? Or something like that. It would just say the thing and not like something nice and positive. Mm-hmm. And people would, the teacher training
Gets
students
offensive.
We had hated it. Like, Mai is so mean. It's just telling me all the stuff I'm doing wrong and bullying me.
Yeah, I kind of felt that when you asked it there. I was like, wow, this AI is a bit of a rude.
And we knew that for our pilot, we were just using these teacher training students. But for our big study, we were going to be with like 12-year-olds in middle schools. And we knew that they would be especially like not liking it if the AI. We made it really like supportive teachery language. We kept showing teachers how it talks and like working on how it should sound to make it 12-year-old appropriate. But yeah,
is that why AI is so sycophantic? Because people really hate it when it's like, yeah, well, you could do better. No, they want the AI to say, wow, what a wonderful idea. This is the most interesting thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, pretty much. I think we needed to basically, the nicer we made it sound, the more people seem to like it. That's not what I used to find in my old, like, in my PhD studies, that to some extent, people don't want the AI to sound creepy in that way and, like, sound like it's just pumping you up and being overly friendly. But at least when you're giving this kind of negative feedback, because it's always trying to support you when you have these challenging moments in your learning. So if you're already pissed off at your group and now the AI is like, hey, you guys are dumb and confused, it's only going to kind of ignite things further.
Clippy
so maybe there's
up.
A time and a place for the like supportive or sycophantic tone.
It seems that you're having social issues with your partner and you're literally punching each other in the face.
Yeah, sometimes it was like that. Or it's like, it would be like, it seems not everyone has had a chance to get their voice heard, as one student is like asleep or walking away from the table. Yeah, so after we piloted it with some Wizard of Oz pilots of like how, when it would talk, when it should talk, how it should talk, then some technical pilots just to make sure we could actually do the speech recognition part. We brought it to a middle school and we were in a 7th grade science classroom. So for us, that's 12 and 13-year-olds doing physics experiments. For 5 weeks, we were in 12 different classrooms. Yeah, and it was supporting collaborative learning across all of those students and all of those groups.
And are you in the space where you can share how well it went, or is this still
to some
alpha?
Extent we're starting to, so the data was collected in the last handful of months and we've been analyzing it, trying to first just like qualitatively coding it, transcribing it for people who don't speak Finnish such as myself. But some early findings we've seen are that if groups had, for example, so all of the tasks were split into different phases. So all of the weekly lessons, first there was like a lecture from the teacher, then there was some hands-on physics thing, there was a worksheet, et cetera. And basically, if you had more of a certain type of challenge 1 week, you would see less of that challenge for the next few weeks. So if you had a bunch of metacognitive challenges in the hands-on physics part in week one, your group would see less and less metacognitive challenges with the hands-on physics part in future weeks. So our hope there is that that indicates that like you kind of are doing these scripts in your head now, that you're like, okay, I don't understand the task. How can we as a group figure out what we're supposed to do right now? Oh, we should do this.
So you want the kids to be like you and the prompt from the AI kind of auto plays in their head.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's our hope, that like we're not trying to be a tech company where every classroom has my. We're basically hoping that we can show up for like a month or two in your class and then you'll never need it again because it'll just play in your head every time you have a challenge.
Teach a man to AI himself.
Exactly. Teach a man to self-regulate. That's why it's self-regulated learning. It's not like my regulated learning.
So yeah, is it so like this little puck or something that you put in the middle of a table and then
basically the hardware for it, we sometimes did it with iPads because they have a speaker and a mic. When we were in the schools, because it was noisier, we had like studio mics on each lab table and just like a little speaker. We're thinking about trying to use other cheaper hardware, like have each kid have one like Bluetooth earbud in, and that would be your own mic and your own speaker.
Right.
But yeah, I the hardware kind of doesn't matter. All that it really matters is that it has a mic and a speaker, and then it connects to our server that does the speech recognition and dialogue management stuff.
And did you have any kind of false positives where people would be having a nice old chat and then the thing pops up out of nowhere?
Oh yeah, all the time. Like not all the time, but that happened plenty. So there was a really great example where Mai was like, hey, it seems tensions are running a little high. How can we talk to each other and make sure we're not offending one another? And the two kids turn to each other with like a sarcastic face. And the one kid's like, oh, sorry, am I offending you right now? And the other kid's like, no, I'm not offended at all, like laughing. Well, there was sometimes moments where like, yeah, if Mai was, it said like, you seem to be confused right now, when they were doing something right, like they weren't confused, they would kind of get confused and they would be like, wait, does Mai know something that we don't? Like, are we doing this all wrong? And then they would be like, hey, teacher, are we on the right track? And the teacher would be like, yeah, you're grand.
And so are you replacing like teaching assistants? Is this where you're trying to go?
No, yeah.
Take so more this jobs?
This is part of One part of this is my Horizon Europe project right now is teacher AI complementarity. So the whole idea of this Horizon EU call is like AI is impacting different workforces, different sectors. That'll mean that people in each job will have and need new skills, new tasks, and it will change the job like at kind of a political and demographic kind of level. So we're looking into how AI can and will affect teaching as a profession insofar as teaching supports collaborative learning. And one of our like insights already is that tons of teachers in at least the classrooms we visited don't bother with collaborative learning because classrooms are kind of big. There's not really enough teachers for them. And they say that if I'm just lecturing in front of the room, it's not too crazy, it's not too loud. But if I have groups of three or four doing their own thing, then I can be with one group at a time and the other groups can be really going off and like either getting stuck and having to wait for me while I make my way around the whole room or just doing something they shouldn't be doing at all. So our hope is that this can at least make collaborative learning more possible in classrooms that have not the best teacher to student ratio, but also it makes it so when a group gets the attention of a teacher, hopefully they've already tried things like reread the task or like talk to each other, the sorts of things that would be like a teacher's first line of like, have you tried asking each other? Have you looked in the book? That way, by the time they get a question from the students, it's a little more kind of specific content level, something a little deeper, some metacognition has already occurred. So our hope is that, yeah, it makes metacognition, or it makes collaborative learning more viable and maybe deeper as a learning tool in a modern classroom where it's harder to support collaborative learning. But we're not really trying to put anyone out of a job with it.
One of the questions I got when I was doing the room reader stuff, which was around like measuring student engagement and so on, is around like, oh, are we increasing Big Brother, like another thing that students have to be recorded, and now maybe this AI is gonna send a message to their parents whenever they misbehave, or are we just increasing how much like Overwatch there is over students?
As someone who hasn't played Overwatch, I can't say for sure. Well, I think to an extent, it depends how this kind of technology gets instantiated. Like if this was like, hey, Google is releasing a new metacognitive support that will listen to you and make a dashboard about you and personalize to you, it would be pretty worrying, because then there would be this level of like, this is targeting you in particular. It's developing a profile. It's Big Brother-y. Yeah, exactly. I don't know if there's such a risk with our tool in specific, particularly because, like, A, it's us running it. Like, it's a university that doesn't really stand to gain by doing that. But also, like, the way we have our server set up, it's not like the model is being trained on individual kids. It's basically, like, approaching a fresh speech recognition and all of that every single time you talk to it. There's no kind of... We keep the transcript of what they said, and we made recordings so we could do analysis, but we're not using that to influence like learning decisions or to go back to parents and say something. I think actually the EU AI Act gets at some of this, of like especially how AI can be used in decision making. And to the extent that we are not making any decisions about the students' education or discipline or whatever, and we didn't even like give a dashboard or some summary report or something to the teacher after, like we didn't say like, hey, group number 7 had 17 socio-emotional triggers, they hate each other. We collect our data, the teacher does their thing, and that's that.
Is like the back end is a type of custom GPT you made, LLM, is it using ChatGPT?
No, it's all just machine learning classifiers trained on like both real data from past experiments and synthetic data based on that real data. So there's no LLMs involved, no GPT, no third-party models. It's just, yeah, up and down classifiers for pretty small, I would say like dialogue variables. So basically like, here's a machine learning classifier that says whether or not what they are talking about is related to science content. And there's a bunch of sentences that are labeled as either this is about science content or this is not about science content as the training data. So then when a student says like, pass the beaker over here, that sentence would be labeled as about science content. And when a student says like, what are you doing this weekend? That would be labeled as no. And it's just a combination of lots and lots of these little dialogue variables building up to make these broader rules about, like, this is a cognitive trigger.
I assume you didn't make the AI. What's your role? Like, where do you fit in?
I made the AI.
Oh, right. Okay.
I designed it. I started out as, like, helping design, like, what even would the architecture of this thing be? And then my learning science colleagues wrote the rules at a high level of what should be recognized. And then I worked with a colleague from University of Twente, who's now in some long-named university in Brazil, some federal southern state, blah, 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 blah. Adelson de Araujo is my colleague. And he...
Wonderful pronunciation.
Thank you. You can tell how close we are as friends and colleagues. I really like Adelson, but I also don't speak Portuguese, so I can't pronounce his name very well. Do you want to give it a try?
I'd have to see it written, because the way you said it could be anything.
Oof. I'll send you his GitHub page so you can say his name.
Adelson de Araújo Jr., and the university would be Instituto Metrópole Digital.
But yeah, he was, for his PhD, developing a configurable chatbot that can have these different rules based on these different, like, low-level things. So he visited us for a month, and me and him worked together to kind of write these rules so that they would fit what we're doing now. And now we're kind of in the process of rewriting some of these rules so they work better in Finnish language, and they can be more configurable, more customizable for our usage. But yeah, I basically did all of the HCI design for sure, and then worked with Adelson to do the technical development. I got the speech recognition part and like speaker recognition, speech diarization part working. And we basically hooked it up to parts of Adelson's chatbot. And then, yeah, that's how it got realized.
Well, here I am underestimating you.
So we worked together on that. And then we here in Oulu are continuing to develop Mai. So there will be new kinds of architectures, new things that we'll be able to recognize. Some of my colleagues are interested in physiological measures and in other kinds of data streams like log data. So we're hoping in the future, not that every kid in a classroom will have a heart rate monitor on, but for example, we have students in nursing education here who use a lot of VR simulations in their training. And they do this, like, they talk to the fake patient, like, it's to train you in how to go through this clinical checklist and, like, ask questions and blah, 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 blah. So you do this fake conversation with the patient, and then you talk to your tutor or your lecturer about, like, okay, here's what I did, here's why I did it, here's what could be improved. And we want to be able to support students in that kind of learning context also, but it's a different kind of conversation. So we're going to have to rely on other data streams like log data. So in the VR simulation, how much are you looking at your like checklist of things you need to ask? How much are you making eye contact with the patient? These sorts of things. So yeah, hoping to integrate more than just the dialogue. But right now it works pretty well with even just the dialogue to support self-regulated learning.
That's cool. So it takes starting a podcast with someone to actually learn what they do, how they do it.
Yeah, I was a little bit dreading of like, it's episode 6. I finally have to say what I do at work.
No, it's cool. I like it.
Yeah, thanks. Follow my and follow my work. You can follow Justin Edwards on like Google Scholar or whatever, and follow LET Lab on LinkedIn. We do cool stuff like this with AI that supports education. I'm Justin Edwards from the University of Oulu.
I'm Diego Garialde from the University College Dublin.
Oh, cool. If this was a written article, that would be called the byline. So I think when we do it, that is the byline.
Nice. HC by, back at it again.
Exactly.
You know what groypers are, right?
Yes.
So isn't there a groyper thing where they want to feminize, they hate women so much they want to feminize men and just turn them all into femboys?
I guess that makes me, wait, I don't want to say that on the microphone. I guess that makes me far right, if that's their ideology.
More femboys. All right. So
finally, it's like horseshoe theory. Finally, something the far left and the far right can agree on.
Beautiful.
I like that we're speed running the let's do the things that get us fired right at the beginning in like 3 minutes, and then let's get down to the research.
Look, will it get edited out? That's a later me.
At least edit it to like the middle or end of the episode. That way, if a colleague decides, like, I'm going to check this thing out, and then immediately it's like, oh, Justin wants to turn the world into femboys. So, well, never mind. Hold on. Yeah, I have opinions about human-computer interaction.
I sent the podcast to my aunt, who's a clinical psychologist, well, retired now. And
did she refer you to a colleague?
Just after I sent it, I just remembered all the furry jokes we made.
Mm.
But she sent back good thoughts. She was like, oh yeah, very interesting, really liked it.
She's like, I'm glad you're having fun with your friends, Diego.
She was like, we should have a coffee when you come back from Brazil so we can talk about it. But now I thought it meant, oh, so we can talk about it, like the interesting insights and whatever. But now you're making me think, so we can talk about your issues.
Yeah, we should have a coffee. Could you fill out this survey before we talk?